and they changed his name to Him That Had His Shoe Drawn Off. That's Mr. Him That Had His Shoe Drawn Off. That was his name from then on. And it was very disrespectful. I can't think of the word that I want. But anyway, it wasn't very good. And what this means, when he said a man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor, what he was saying is, here, you stand in my shoes and do what I was supposed to do. Well, this is what the law had to do. The law had to move over and say, I cannot redeem them. You stand in my place. And this is what Jesus did. He stood in the place of the law. He met every demand of the law, but at the same time, he redeemed men. Notice that he drew off his shoe and he gave it to Boaz. Stand in my shoes. All right. Now, the thing that we want to notice again, he didn't give him both shoes, just gave him one of them. And so it tells us the law still stands on one foot, pointing men unto Christ. This is what Paul means by schoolmaster, showing them their need, that they cannot keep the law and please God of their own accord. It's impossible for men to be justified by the deeds of the law, and the law proves that. It bears it out continually, showing all men to be sinners and guilty before God because of the weakness of the flesh. All right, verse 9, Boaz said to the elders and to the people, you are witnesses this day. I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's of the hand of Naomi. And said, now you're a witness, all right? The law did witness that. The Ten Commandments were a direct witness of the inability of the law to redeem humanity. Men might think that they had kept the whole law. Remember what the young man said? Well, these I have kept from my youth up. Jesus says, one thing thou lackest. Go sell everything you had and give it to the poor and follow me. And the man went away very sorrowful, for he was very rich. So you see, it could not, even those commandments witnessed to the fact that he did not have the love for his neighbor that he should have had. Jesus summed up the law in that, in those few words. So the Ten Commandments actually are a witness that men are unable to keep any part of the law. And at the same time, it is a direct manifestation that the redemption of Jesus is all right, because we find that the righteousness of the law is fulfilled in us who walk not after the flesh but after the Spirit. And so Christ actually supplied what the law demanded. The law couldn't supply it itself in us, but Christ supplied what that law demanded. And so a witness. All right, in verse 11, all the people that were in the gate and the elders said, yes, we're witnesses. The Lord make the woman that is come unto thine house like Rachel and Leah. And God did just about that, because this woman, Ruth, is in the direct lineage of Christ. She was not even a Jew, but God offset that, and he brought her in to that place. All right. Now then we come to some more wonderful dispensational truth. In verse 14, the women said unto Naomi, by the way, this, verse 13, Boaz took Ruth, she was his wife, and he went into her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. And the women said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord, which has not left thee this day without a kinsman, that his name may be famous in Israel. And he shall be unto thee a restorer of thy life. Now then, here again is where we find something wonderful, because you remember, as I said, that Naomi is representative of that ancient nation of Israel unto whom all of the promises of God apply. So notice what happens unto that ancient nation after the remnant comes forth. Now the remnant of Israel is actually those full overcomers out of the nation of Israel that come forth before a nation is born in one day. All right, when they come forth, they actually give such a testimony of Christ that it becomes a restorer of life unto the nation of Israel. This is where a nation is born in one day. And so we have here, verse 15, he shall be unto thee, that is Christ, because he has been manifested by this remnant. Christ has come on the scene. Israel can see him. Israel is a nation. To them he is very much manifest. And so in that way, he shall be a restorer of thy life, a nourisher of thine old age, for thy daughter-in-law, which loves thee, is better to you than seven sons, has borne him. And Naomi took the child, even as the nation of Israel is just going to embrace Christ. They didn't do this at his first advent, but they are going to at his second advent. And so they took the child, they laid it in her bosom, and became nurse unto it. They're just going to take it as a mother would a child. Of course, the reverse will be true, because Christ will be taking care of them. But the attitude that is expressed is what is true of the nation of Israel. Well, the women, her neighbors came in verse 17. They said, there's a son born to Naomi. Notice, it's not born to Ruth, it's born to Naomi. And so it is very important for the nation of Israel when they have this revelation. And they called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now, these generations in these names, you can find a separate place to write down through here, because they express some wonderful things concerning the nation of Israel and things which will happen in the end time. They actually give us a prophecy of Israel and what is going to happen. So first is Phares. His name means a breaking forth. And it tells us literally of the breaking forth and resurrection that Israel is going to have. Israel is a nation. Alright? Hezron means to be green. And it tells us of the development of that resurrected life, of restored Israel. Israel is not just going to be born and be a baby. They are really going to grow and to become the real evangelists of God for the whole world. So Hezron means to be green. So Israel will be developed. All right, the next one is Ram. And it means exalted. It shows continual, or continuous rather, growth. It is continuous development in the things of God, because that nation is going to just increase so bountifully and become a spiritual nation. We haven't seen one of those. We've seen a few people that have been spiritual out of nations, but this is going to be a spiritual nation leading the rest of the nations. Amminadab. And this is important. It means my willing people. And at last, Israel is going to be the willing people that God has always wanted. No longer will he record such words of them as, thou art a stiff-necked people and you've got a heart of stone and things of this nature. They will be willing in that day and submissive unto God. Nashon means to shine. And again, it shows Israel as that bright and shining light. Jesus gave the parable. He says, you don't take a light and put it under a bushel, but you put it out where everybody can see it. Israel is going to be that light that will shine out unto the rest of the nations. Salmon means raiment, and it tells us of the garments of salvation that Israel will wear. They will really exhibit the traits of redemption. The next one is Boaz. His name means strength. And Israel will recognize Christ as their strength, and therefore they will be strong. And all of these things can apply unto our own personal lives, the developments that we find in our own lives, that we come forth in resurrection life, and we begin to grow in spiritual things and develop, and we begin to become witnesses of the Lord and to shine for Him. We learn our strength, which is in Christ. The next one, the next name is Obed. It means servant, and it continues with the thought that this is Israel's occupation of being servant unto God and yielding to Him. Next one is Jesse, and it simply means Jehovah is, and anything else that you want to put back there in the good way, then it would fit. Jehovah is, because He is everything unto Israel. He's their life giver, their life sustainer, their companion, their guide, their leader, their shepherd, whatever you want to name. Jehovah is unto Israel. The last one is David. His name means beloved king, and it signifies Israel, who will reign in conjunction with Christ over the world, or in the world rather, because Jesus is going to take that dominion. He will become the king of Israel. And of course, Israel will be reigning in that sense of the word as being the head of the nations. And so they will become David at that particular time. All right. Any questions?
Pharez
means a breaking forth. It tells us the coming forth in resurrection life. And that literally means that Israel will be resurrected. It corresponds to the dry bones that in Ezekiel's boneyard, you remember how they were all dry and lifeless, and yet they began to jump together by themselves and became an army. Well, this is what Israel will do. They're dry bones right now, but they're going to have a resurrection. Okay, anyone else? All right, we'll take about 5 minutes to come back to 1 Samuel. Book of 1 Samuel now, and this, as we will notice, happens right about the same time of the judges, because it says in the time of the judges, but a little later. But this man, chapter 1, verse 2, he had two wives, the name of the one Hannah, the name of the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, Hannah had no children. Now, again, we're going to notice that how that God brings his man to the front. It seems like they go along, and of course, it's more pronounced if you would really go into the chronological view of it, as far as years that elapsed between the time they had a real leader and when they didn't. But as we go through the scripture, you will find how that maybe a man passes off the scene, and there may not be any particular man that God deals with for a certain period of time. It just seems like things are topsy-turvy. But God is getting ready to bring a wonderful man on the scene. I love the study of this man, and he has so many wonderful traits and characteristics, as we will notice, and his birth is unique. And you will also find this true in the scripture, that when men had a supernatural birth, they were born to women of faith. You also find that there was just something unique about those children, how that God really had his hands upon them. All right, so there were these two women. This man had the two wives, and one of them had children, the other did not. Now, the man loved, his name was Elkanah, and he loved this wife, Hannah, more than Peninnah. But verse 5, Hannah had no children, so he gave her a worthy portion. He loved Hannah, but the Lord had shut up her womb. And notice that her adversary also provoked her sore, for to make her fret, because the Lord had shut up her womb, and as he did so year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, so she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. Now there are two different classes of people represented by Hannah and Peninnah. Peninnah represents that one that just seems like they are so fruitful and just doesn't take anything for them to bear. But they also are representative of the ones who are fruitful by themselves. Hannah represents the one who depends upon the Lord for supernatural fruit. And so it must be in our lives if it's any good unto God. We don't read that Peninnah's fruit ever brought any glory unto God. But Hannah's son most assuredly brought much glory unto God. And these same type people who are, well, you describe them as the legal people, they're fruitful by their own efforts and just everything so beautiful with them apparently. Verse 6, they also have a tendency to do this. Her adversary also provoked her sore. And you find that to be true, that legal people will always measure other people by themselves. And this is a very wrong thing to do. We're not to establish ourselves as a measuring line of spirituality for anybody. The Word of God is the only measuring line that we have. And so this certainly is not a good atmosphere when people do that. They always push others down, and it puffs themselves so far up the grace of God can't reach them. So notice that the Lord had shut up her womb. And this is very important that we realize, as we have before, that it is God who makes us fruitful. And we must realize that he is the only one who is able to do that. Well, she was concerned about it, and we should be concerned about it too. That is Hannah. And so she wept and she did not eat. And we come to this place too, really should, because We should want to bear fruit unto God. There's not a thing wrong with that desire. It is a very healthy desire. But don't let your desire get out in front of the Lord. Even though you do have a great desire, let the Lord make you fruitful instead of putting on airs of spirituality. Verse 11, she said, she vowed a vow unto the Lord. She said, if you will look on the affliction of thine handmaid, and it is an affliction because we are unable to bear fruit. We are afflicted to the extent that we can't bear. If you will look on that affliction, Lord, and remember me, and not forget thine handmaid, will give him unto thine handmaid a man-child. I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life. There shall come no razor upon his head. Now there's a little different attitude here in Hannah's case than there was in Jephthah's case in the book of Judges. And we will see more of that later on in Hannah's life. Because she is making a request and actually to glorify the Lord, as we will notice. And she's going to give him unto the Lord. Well, this should be our attitude too, that whatever we have and whatever we are becomes God's. She was in the temple praying at this time, and she prayed in her heart, and her lips moved, but she really didn't say anything. And Eli said to her in verse 14, how long will you be drunk? Put away your wine from you. Well, she was a very deeply spiritual woman, as we're going to find out. But she was not daunted by Eli's insinuations at all. She just answered him in a very quiet spirit. She said, no, I'm a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I've drunk neither wine nor strong drink. I've poured out my soul before the Lord. She says, don't take me for a daughter of the devil. Eli said in verse 17, go in peace, the God of Israel grant you your petition, which you ask of him. And so she represents there some traits for us, rather than retaliate against people, rather to abide in a quiet spirit and so on, because it wouldn't have done any good to tell him off. Anyway, the Lord was faithful unto her in verse 27. For this child, she said, I pray, the Lord has given me my petition which I ask of him. Therefore, I have lent him unto the Lord, or I have given him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he shall be given to the Lord. He worshiped the Lord there. So notice that God used her to bring this child into the world, and then she literally gave him unto God. We find out in chapter 2, that her attitude was right. She was not bargaining with God the way that Jephthah was doing. If you'll do this for me, Lord, then such and such will happen. But she was literally pouring herself out unto the Lord, and just a matter of giving herself completely unto him. And this song in chapter 2 actually brings out her true heart attitudes. And this is what is so very important unto us. Actions, many times you cannot always judge actions. It is the heart attitudes that are important with God. And so in verse 1, Hannah prayed and said, my heart rejoices in the Lord. Now, this song is something that she had learned by experience. We will notice some more things that God uses this song for. But right now, I just want to notice her experience, because it dictates the kind of experience that she had and what she had been through. And so the same trials and afflictions should produce the same types of attitudes and so forth in our hearts. So when she gave this son to the Lord, she did not have a face that was cast down and just as long as it could possibly be. Rather, she had a very rejoicing spirit, and she says, my heart rejoices in the Lord. And this is the first thing we learn about her, is that she learned the source of her strength. She knew she couldn't bear a child of herself, and so she said, my heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn, or my strength, my power, is exalted in the Lord, and my mouth is enlarged over mine enemies. Now, this is what the Lord does for us. He leads us into a time of experience and weakness and dependence upon himself. But when he does deliver us, we know that it is his deliverance. And then our mouths are enlarged over our enemies. I rejoice in your salvation. Now, I want to emphasize all the way through here how that Hannah is speaking by experience. These are not just pretty words that someone has told her. She's found out by experience that the Lord is her strength. She has found out by experience that He is her salvation, or that He has delivered her. And there is Samuel to prove it. All right. Verse 2, there is none holy as the Lord. There is none beside thee, neither is there any rock like our God. Talk no more so exceeding proudly. Let not arrogancy come out of your mouth, for the Lord is a God of knowledge. By Him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty men are broken, and they that stumbled are girded with strength. They that were full have hired out themselves for bread. They that were hungry ceased. So that the barren is born seven, she that has many children is waxed feeble. Now you don't have to guess very many times before you know who she's talking about in these verses. It's Peninnah. And she turns it right back around on her, and she's just simply saying in so many words that all of that fruitfulness and all that provocation that she dealt out to me before is worth nothing, because the one that was barren has borne seven. Now, she didn't have seven children, but it just simply means the perfection of fruit. And this is what God will do in our lives. He will produce a perfect fruit in us. And then she that has many children, that is in herself and by her own abilities and so forth, and she thought in her own strength, she's waxed feeble. And so men's works, their own fleshly efforts, are going to come to naught. And then the Lord kills, He makes alive, brings down to the grave, brings up. She recognizes the superiority of the Lord and the power and the authority that He has. He makes poor, He makes rich, He brings low, He lifts up, He raises up the poor, and so on. Now then, this was just the local fulfillment or the local attitudes and feelings of Hannah. And sometime when you read, have time, just read through that and just identify with Hannah as to what she was really trying to say. We've just gone into a very small portion of it. The part that I really want to go into is the fact that Hannah's song at this point actually describes three dispensations. Verses 1 to 4a is a dispensation of the law, as we will notice in just a moment. 4b to verse 9 is the dispensation of grace. And verse 10 is the millennium period, or the kingdom age. Now I will describe why this is true right now. All right, verses 1 to 4a. As I said, they describe, or they portray, depict, the age of law. She says, "My heart rejoices in the Lord, my horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth is enlarged over my enemies. I rejoice in thy salvation. There is none holy as the Lord, none beside thee, no rock like our God. Talk no more so exceeding proudly. Let not arrogancy come out of your mouth. The Lord is a God of knowledge. By Him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken." All of these things were actually brought to the fore in the age of the law. Because God was exalted. Remember the time that Israel exalted the Lord, and down through the ages, David, Moses, Joshua, all these many men declared the wonderful works of God. My mouth is enlarged over mine enemies. There were wonderful victories for Israel back there. But verse 2 expresses it more. There is none holy as the Lord. The law was an expression of the holiness of God. This showed what Israel must do to bring themselves up to God's righteous standards. There is none beside thee. The law showed that forth too, that there was none that could even compare with God in any way, form, or fashion. There is no rock like our God. He proved that time and again unto Israel in the age of law when He defended them against their enemies. Talk no more so exceeding proudly. You find the pride and the arrogancy of Israel brought out during the age of the law. Those stiff-necked, rebellious, arrogant people was something else to behold. But anyway, it was expressed during the age of law. Notice, the Lord is a God of knowledge. Well, the law showed up all of that, to realize that God was a God of knowledge as to who they were and what they were. By Him actions are weighed. Culmination, verse 4, the bows of the mighty men are broken. This happened actually at the cross, because here is where Jesus did away with the bloodless religion, and this is literally what the law was insofar as spiritual things are concerned, because men wanted to live and to be justified by their own works. and deny the blood of Christ. And this is brought out by the fact that the bows of the mighty men are broken. There are no arrows, but the bows are broken. And that's about all the law was as far as men's works were concerned. They told of a bloodless religion. Even though all of those sacrifices and everything prevailed, insofar as Israel's spirituality concerned, they sought to be justified by their own works rather than the blood of Christ. So the bows of the mighty men are broken. That ends the age of law.